Chapter 34. It was residence parking only in the street, but it was Saturday, so there were no restrictions, and Ray found a parking space close to where the sat-nav said Lily lived. Lily's flat was in a mansion block in a side street, a red brick building with a flight of stone steps leading up to a front door with symmetrically patterned stained glass windows. He pressed her buzzer, and after a few seconds heard a hesitant, "Hello?"
"Lily, hi. I'm a friend of Mrs. Way's," said Ray.
"Missy Way?"
"She gave me your address."
"Missy Way gave you my address? Why?"
"I just need to talk to you, Lily."
"I am not allowed visitor."
"I just need to talk to you, that's all."
"And Mrs. Way sent you?"
"Yeah."
There was a silence lasting several seconds, and then the door lock buzzed. Ray pushed open the door. He headed up a green, carpeted stairway. Lily's flat was on the third floor, and she already had the door open when he reached it. She'd put the security chain on and was peering nervously through the gap. At first, he thought it was a child. She was barely 5 feet tall, but as he got closer, he realized she was older, but not much. She had long black hair, and all he could see was one almond-shaped eye. He smiled.
"Hello,"
he said. The eye stared back at him suspiciously.
"Who are you?"
"My name's Ray. Mrs. Way gave me your address."
"You are a client? I don't see clients anymore."
"No, I'm not a client. I just want to talk to you."
He held up his hands and flashed her his most disarming smile.
"I'm a nice guy, really."
"I'm not supposed to let anyone in."
"I understand, but I won't be long, and it's not a good idea to talk out here. The neighbours might hear."
She bit down on her lower lip, then unhooked the chain and opened the door. She was wearing a white shirt and light blue jeans ripped at the knee. Her bare feet were tiny, the toenails spots of scarlet. Her bright red lipstick matched her nail polish.
"You can't stay long," she said.
As she closed the door, Ray could see that although she was tiny, she was definitely not a child. But she was still a teenager, no doubt about that. She walked down the hallway, her waist-length hair brushing the top of her jeans. From the way she swung her hips, Ray was pretty sure she knew he was watching her. She took him past a small red shrine in which a joss stick was burning, into a small sitting room with a low black leather sofa and a coffee table, across which were scattered a dozen fashion magazines. There was a big screen television on a stand that was filled with DVDs of Chinese movies and soap operas. She turned and put her hands together, like a waitress about to tell him the day's specials.
"Is Mrs. Way okay?" she asked.
"She's fine."
"Please tell her that I miss her a lot."
"I will," said Ray, though he doubted that he'd be seeing Mrs. Way again.
She sat down on the sofa and smiled at him. At least, her lips smiled. Her eyes seemed to be full of sadness, as if she was close to tears.
"And you can tell her that I am well. I don't want her to worry about me."
"Why don't you call her? Tell her yourself."
She gave a barely audible sigh, then shook her head.
"It is forbidden," she said quietly.
"Forbidden?"
She frowned.
"Is that the wrong word? I mean, I do not have permission. It is not allowed."
"By who? C.K. Lee?"
She nodded but didn't reply, as if she was afraid of uttering his name.
"Your English is good."
She smiled at the compliment.
"Thank you."
"Do you go to school here?"
"No. Mr. Lee won't allow that, but I watch a lot of television. It was hard at first, but I'm getting better."
"Well, it's working. How old are you, darling?"
She jutted up her chin like a defiant child.
20, she said.
"You don't have to lie to me. I'm not a cop."
17,
she said quietly.
"And how long has Lee been taking care of you?"
"A year or two."
"Since you were 16?
15, she said. "My parents sent me here to work."
"From where?"
She wrinkled her nose, as if she didn't understand the question.
"Where were you before?" asked Ray.
"China, of course," she said.
"They sent you to London to work?"
She nodded.
"They are poor. This way, I can send money back to them."
"Lee pays for you?"
She nodded again.
"He takes care of me.
And you're okay with that?
She shrugged. What can I do? My family need money.
And your parents knew what you would be doing here?
The man who arranged it said I was to be a waitress.
Ray rubbed the back of his neck.
Oh, I'm sorry, darling.
It's okay.
You like this C.K. Lee?
Her eyes hardened.
I hate him.
Why?
She turned her back on him and undid her shirt. She let it fall down to her waist, and he saw a large dragon tattooed on her back, mainly black, but with green eyes and red flames shooting from its jaws.
He made me have this.
He made you?
After he took me away from Mrs. Way, he took me to a tattoo shop.
She pulled her shirt back on and turned around to face him as she buttoned it up.
He said he liked to look at the dragon while he fucked me.
I'm sorry, he said.
She shrugged, her face blank.
It's not your fault.
She sat down and put her hands in her lap.
Is this better than working for Mrs. Way?
She shrugged again.
Before, I had to see a lot of men every day. Now I see only Mr. Lee. But he doesn't come to see me often. I'm like his prisoner.
She shrugged again.
It's boring.
Did he ever take you to his house?
Sometimes, she said.
Where is it, his house?
I don't know.
North London? South? West?
I always went in his car. It was a big house. Modern. Very expensive. But I don't know where it was. I don't know London very well. Mr. Lee doesn't like me going out on my own. He says if I go out, the police will catch me and send me back to China.
Did you cross the river?
She frowned.
I don't think so.
So, north of the river, said Ray. He smiled. That's something anyway.
You should ask Mr. Zhu. He's a good friend of Mr. Lee. Mr. Zhu will probably know where Mr. Lee lives.
Who is he?
He owns a restaurant in Kensington. Mr. Lee took me to eat there sometimes.
She smiled.
Very good food, but so expensive.
What's the name of the restaurant?
She said something in Chinese and then put her hand over her mouth.
Oh, I'm sorry. In English, it's called The Peach Garden. It's near Harrods.
Thank you, Lily.
She smiled coyly.
Do you want to fuck me? You can.
Ray's jaw dropped.
God, no.
You don't like young girls? All men like young girls.
Lily, darling, you're as cute as fuck, but you're way too young for me. No offence.
She frowned.
What do you mean, no offence?
I mean, I don't want to upset you. You're lovely, but I'm not here for sex. I just want to find C.K. Lee.
Have you got children?
Ray nodded.
A son.
She smiled.
I bet you're a good father.
Ray shook his head.
No, I'm not a father.
He shrugged.
It's a long story.
He looked at his watch.
I'm going to have to go, Lily. You know, you can go to the police.
They'll send me back to China.
But at least you'll be away from Lee.
And my family will have no money.
She shrugged.
Better I stay.
Ray turned to go, then stopped.
Have you got a phone?
She nodded.
Can I borrow it?
Of course.
She picked up an iPhone off a table and handed it to him. He tapped in his number and gave it back to her.
If you have any problems, you call me. My name's Ray.
Ray,
she repeated.
If anything happens, if you need help, just call me.
I don't think anyone can help me, she said,
and lowered her eyes. Ray had a sudden urge to wrap his arms around her, but he knew how that would end, and he had a job to do. Chapter 35. The hour before going out to warm up on the pitch was the time Gabe hated the most. Once he was out and kicking a ball around and the crowd were cheering, the adrenaline kicked in and the body did its thing. But after the briefing and before the warm-up, there was nothing to do, nothing to occupy the mind. Before Gattuso's arrival at the club, most of the players would lose themselves in their phones or iPads, fooling around on social media or watching videos or listening to music. The ban on electrical equipment might have helped build team spirit, but it slowed time to a crawl. He wandered into the briefing area and grabbed an energy bar. He chewed on it as he went back into the changing room. Mancini, Devereaux and Armati were lying on massage beds as physios worked on them. Brian Lawrence was examining Reed's shoulder, getting him to raise and lower his left arm as he watched the muscle groups move. Babacar was on a rowing machine, maintaining a slow and steady pace. Wood and Fernandez had already changed into their training kit and were on exercise bikes, apparently racing. Gabe usually spent 10 or 15 minutes on one of the bikes to loosen up and get the blood flowing, but he couldn't be bothered exercising, and instead he sat down on the bench in front of his locker and put his head in his hands.
"You okay, Gabe?" asked Fernandez.
Gabe looked up. The Argentinian was sitting in front of his locker, reading a glossy car magazine. Like Gabe, he hadn't gotten round to changing into his training kit. Gabe forced a smile.
"Yeah, you look like shit. Thanks. Do you want to play cards or something?"
Fernandez was a keen poker player, well known around the city's casinos. Gabe had played with him a few times, and the Argentinian tended to win more often than he lost.
"Think I'll get some air," Gabe said.
He headed out of the changing room and back to the exit. He went outside and found Moretti and Mapplethorpe smoking. They reacted like guilty schoolboys, palming their cigarettes and holding their breath. McNamara was vehemently against smoking, his hatred of the vice honed by his 10 years of abstinence. But Gutozo was a heavy smoker, so cigarettes hadn't found their way onto the list of finable activities, providing it was done outside. Mapplethorpe blew smoke up at the cloudless sky.
"Oh, you had me going there, Gabe," he said. "Thought it was Joe."
"Joe's not in there. He's probably checking the pitch," said Gabe.
He took out his phone. Ray hadn't called back.
"You got a bit on the side, Gabe?" asked Mapplethorpe.
Gabe frowned.
"What?"
he said, as he slid the phone back into his pocket.
"The way you keep checking your phone. Got something on the go."
"Behave, Tim," said Gabe. "My missus is a doctor. Can you imagine the damage she could do with a scalpel?"
"I'm just pulling the chain," said Mapplethorpe. "Laura's the real deal. She and Ollie coming today."
Gabe tried to smile, but he felt his lips scrape across his teeth.
"Should be," he said.
His eyes filled with tears of anger and frustration, so he turned around and went back inside. He let the door close behind him as he blinked away his tears. He had never felt so helpless. His wife and son were in mortal danger, and he had to pretend as if life was going ahead as usual. It was a regular Saturday match day, something he'd been through hundreds of times before, except he had to make sure that his team lost, and if they didn't, Laura and Ollie would die.
"You know what would relax you?" asked Mapplethorpe.
Gabe hadn't been listening.
"What?"
Mapplethorpe repeated the question and held out his pack of cigarettes. Gabe laughed and waved them away.
"I'm not going to start smoking at my age, you soft bastard," he said.
"You need something, Gabe," said Mapplethorpe. "You're very tightly wound at the moment."
"No, I'm not."
"You were gritting your teeth just then."
He gestured with his cigarette at Gabe's temple. "And you've got a vein just there that's throbbing like it's set to burst." Gabe put his hand up to his head, but then realized Mapplethorpe was joking. He pointed his finger at Mapplethorpe's face.
"Fuck off," he said. "I'm just saying, you need to chill. You're captain now."
"Acting captain."
"You know what I mean," said Mapplethorpe. "If you're tense, the team gets tense. Eric was a prick sometimes, but he was quietly confident when it came to match day, and that rubs off on everyone else."
"Okay." Gabe knew that Mapplethorpe was talking sense. His role as captain, acting captain, was to lead from the front. On any normal Saturday, he'd have absolutely no problem with that, and would even relish the responsibility. But this was no ordinary Saturday, and this was no ordinary match. If his team won, his family would die. But there was no way he could ever explain that to Mapplethorpe, so he forced a smile and nodded.
"Yeah, you're right," he said.
"We've got this game in the bag," said Mapplethorpe. "Chelsea are in a red state at the moment. We'll run rings around them. Your first time as captain, and you win. That's the result, right?"
He punched Gabe lightly on the shoulder.
"Fuck me.
I wish I was in your shoes.
Chapter 36. The Peach Garden was a high-end restaurant with crisp white tablecloths and tall glasses containing orchids on every table. The place was pretty much full, even though it was after 2 p.m. At least half the customers were Asian, which suggested the cuisine was authentic, but Ray wasn't there for the food. A pretty Chinese girl in a gold and red Chong Sam standing at a lectern asked him if he had a booking.
"I need to see Mr. Zhu," said Ray.
"He's busy," said the girl,
but the quick glance she gave a door at the rear of the restaurant was enough to tell Ray which way to go. A waiter blocked his way, but two quick jabs to his solar plexus had him doubled over, coughing and wheezing. There was a private sign on the door, but Ray pushed through and headed up a flight of bare stairs. There were two doors at the top, and one had a sign saying Office. Ray threw it open. A middle-aged man in a dark suit was sitting at a computer terminal, peering at the screen over a pair of half-moon spectacles. He jumped as if he'd been hit when the door slammed open. His mouth worked soundlessly as Ray kicked the door shut and walked quickly across the room. There was a television screen on the wall opposite the desk showing a sports program.
"Are you Zhu?" asked Ray.
The man nodded.
"Who are you?"
"I'm the guy who's going to break every bone in your body if you don't tell me what I want to know."
The man frowned.
"What?"
Ray swept the computer off the desk with his arm, and it crashed to the floor. Zhu's high-backed chair was on rollers, and he pushed himself back until it hit the wall. Ray moved quickly, sidestepping the desk and grabbing Zhu by the throat.
"You can't do this to me," stammered Zhu.
Ray grinned savagely.
"I'm pretty sure I can."
Zhu pointed up at a black plastic dome by the entrance.
"I've got CCTV.
And I've got a couple of mates who'll put a bullet in your head and bury you in concrete if that CCTV footage goes anywhere near the cops," said Ray. "Now, this can go one of two ways. You tell me what I want to know, or I beat the crap out of you, and then you tell me what I want to know. There is a third option, and that's that I beat you so bad that you can't tell anything to anyone. But that's unlikely, because I'm pretty good at hurting people. Please."
Ray tightened his grip on the man's throat.
"I don't want to hear please. I don't want to hear you offer me money or promise me the world if I just let you go. All I want to hear are the answers to my questions. Understand? Just nod if you understand."
Zhu nodded fearfully. The door opened, and a waiter stood there. He wasn't the one Ray had punched downstairs. He was bigger and holding a large kitchen knife. He froze in the doorway when he saw Ray with his hand on Zhu's throat.
"Tell him everything's all right and to go back downstairs," said Ray. "If you don't, I'll beat you to a pulp, and then I'll rip your restaurant apart."
Zhu nodded fearfully and then said something to the waiter in Chinese. The waiter replied, and Zhu spoke again, louder this time.
"Tell him not to call the cops," said Ray.
"I'm not fucking stupid," said the man, lowering his knife. "I can speak English."
"This is between me and Zhu," said Ray. "But if you don't get the fuck out of here, it'll be between you and me, and that knife won't worry me a bit. Now fuck off downstairs, and don't even think about calling the cops."
"Do as he says," croaked Zhu.
The man nodded and left the office, giving Ray a final glare before he closed the door.
"Good," said Ray,
tightening his grip on Zhu's throat.
"Now, I need an address for C.K. Lee. I need to know where he lives."
Ray relaxed his hand slightly, and Zhu gasped for air.
"I don't know where he..."
Ray cut him off by tightening his grip.
"I don't want to hear 'don't know,'" he said. "That's not what I want. You're his friend. You have to know where he lives."
Zhu tried to shake his head, but Ray's grip was relentless.
"Are you going to make me hurt you, Mr. Zhu? Because I've hurt a lot of people already today, and the gloss has kind of gone off it."
He put his face right up against Zhu's, so their noses were almost touching.
"The next words out of your mouth had better be Lee's address, or I'm going to start bouncing you off the walls."
Ray let go of Zhu's throat, and the man began to babble.
I don't know. I promise you, I don't know," he said,
the words coming out so fast that they practically ran together.
"He's never taken me to his house. I've no idea where he lives. I swear. Please don't hurt me."
Ray snarled and drew back his fist. Zhu's arms began to flail, and his eyes almost popped out of their sockets.
"But I know where he is right now,"
he stammered. I know where you can find him.
Ray's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
Where?
Zhu pointed at the television screen with his left hand.
He'll be at the United match. He's got a box. He'll be watching the game.
Ray looked over at the screen and realised that it was the stadium where Gabe would soon be playing.
Are you sure?
Yes, I've been there. It's one of the best boxes, close to the halfway line.
So why aren't you there with him?
He didn't offer. Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't.
Ray released his grip on Zhu's throat and pointed a warning finger at the man's face.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back to rip you limb from limb. CCTV or no CCTV.
Zhu wiped his mouth with his sleeve.
It's the truth.
Ray jabbed his finger at Zhu's face again.
And if you warn Lee, I swear to God I'll kill you. I'll do it personally, and I'll do it with pleasure.
Zhu put up his hands.
I won't tell him. It's none of my business. This is between you and him, and I want nothing to do with it.
Ray stared at Zhu for several seconds, then nodded slowly.
Okay, he said. We're good.
Zhu flinched as Ray reached out to adjust his shirt and tie, then straightened the shoulders of his jacket.
No harm done, right? We're good.
Zhu swallowed nervously.
Yes, we're good.
Ray patted Zhu on the shoulder, and he flinched again.
I'll be on my way then, he said. You have a nice day.
Ray turned to go, then gestured at the television. Two commentators were discussing the match against the backdrop of the crowded stadium.
Have you got a bet on the match?
Zhu nodded.
Yeah? Who do you think's going to win?
Chelsea, croaked Zhu. By 2 goals.
Good luck with that,
said Ray, as he headed for the door. Service was carrying on as normal when Ray stepped into the restaurant. The three waiters turned to glare at Ray as he walked by, but he ignored them. He looked at his watch. 2:20. Kickoff in 40 minutes. Chapter 37. McNamara let the Chelsea team go out to warm up first. He always let the visitors go ahead so that they would bear the full brunt of the home team's supporters as they jeered and catcalled. The Chelsea fans were segregated in a corner section of the stadium, 4,500 in all, and no matter how hard they cheered, they would always be drowned out by the home fans. McNamara let Chelsea have the pitch to themselves for 2 minutes, then had the team line up in the tunnel. Gabe was at the head of the line, bobbing from side to side, the adrenaline coursing through his system. The coach patted him on the back.
Give them another minute, he said.
Gabe grinned. He knew all too well how unpleasant it was to be on the receiving end of the naked hostility of tens of thousands of chanting fans. Eventually, McNamara nodded and pointed down the tunnel. Gabe started jogging down the tunnel. As he reached the entrance, the crowd saw him coming, and the stadium filled with roars and cheers. As always, the hairs on the back of Gabe's neck stood on end, and he felt a chill run down his spine. There was no other feeling like it in the world. The open adoration of thousands of fans, many of whom loved the club almost as much as they loved their families. Gabe left the tunnel and jogged between the seats where the coaching staff and substitutes would sit and onto the pitch. The sound was deafening, a vibration as much as a noise that had his stomach churning. He looked around at the sea of Wolford United colours and forced a smile. He waved his right hand in salute and headed for the goalmouth to his left. The Chelsea team were passing a couple of balls around at the other end of the pitch, and their goalkeeper was doing some warm-up exercises. Gabe jogged on the spot, then did a few star jumps. The pre-match warm-up was more for marketing reasons than anything else. The players could do all the warming-up they wanted in the changing rooms, but an on-pitch warm-up meant the club could sell advertising space on the training kit, so all the players had to turn out and go through the motions. He heard his name being called, and he turned to see Mapplethorpe kicking the ball towards him. Gabe reacted instinctively, trapping the ball on his chest, dropping it down to the ground and kicking it back. He jogged on the spot, then ran over to intercept a ball that Mancini had sent skidding across the grass. Gabe could feel the anticipation building. Kickoff was just 30 minutes away. He looked up at the windows of the family box. That was where Laura and Ollie would usually be. Ollie would always wave and give him a thumbs up, but not today. Chapter 38. Ray had the route to the stadium on the BMW sat-nav, but the traffic was bad on the route it selected, so he ignored it and took a series of rat runs through East London. He took a left down a narrow road, then a hard right. A man on a bike shouted at him, but Ray barely heard him over the roar of the engine. He took another left, then a right, then braked at a line of traffic, stopped at a red light. Ray cursed and beat a rapid tattoo on his steering wheel. There was a knock on the driver's window, and Ray turned to look at an angry cyclist.
"Oi! You cut me up back there!"
Ray scowled at the man. He was in his 30s with a black-and-white swept-back helmet that had a small camera mounted on it. He was wearing a tight yellow shirt and even tighter black pants and bright blue gloves. Ray doubted that the man could see through the tinted windows of the BMW.
"You owe me an apology for what you did back there!" shouted the man.
He knocked on the window again. Ray looked ahead. The lights were still on red. The cyclist knocked again, harder this time.
"You're on video, you know. Caught on camera. I'll be downloading this on YouTube when I get home."
Ray stared straight ahead.
"Come on, wind this window down and apologise, or I'll report you to the police."
The man had one of those whiny, upper-class voices that suggested a lifetime of entitlement, and he clearly wasn't going to stop harassing Ray, so Ray opened the door and slammed it against the man's leg. The man yelped, and Ray pulled the door back and slammed it even harder the second time. He heard the satisfying crack of something breaking, and the man and his bike toppled into the road. The man began sobbing like a little girl. Ray closed the door. The light turned green, and the cars ahead of him began to move. Ray pounded on his horn, encouraging them to move faster. He looked at the clock on the dashboard. Kickoff was just 15 minutes away.
Chapter 39. Laura pushed herself up the bed, using her heels against the duvet and rolling her shoulders.
"Mum, what are you doing?"
She could hear her son, but not see him.
"I'm trying to sit up, honey, that's all."
The man who brought them water had refused to untie them. He'd helped her sit up while he held the bottle to her mouth, and then did the same for Ollie. When he'd finished giving them water, he'd been about to replace the duct tape around their mouths, but Laura had begged him not to. He'd agreed not to gag them, but promised that if he heard any noise at all, he'd be back upstairs.
"I'm scared," said Ollie. "I know, but it's going to be all right. Why are they doing this? They want Daddy to lose his game today." "That's stupid," said Ollie. "Why would they want him to lose? Anyway, he's not going to lose, is he?"
"I don't know," said Laura.
She pushed herself again and managed to get her head against the headboard. She grunted and pushed harder and got her shoulders up and with a final shove forced herself into a sitting position. She could see Ollie lying on his back on the couch.
"Ollie, over here," she said.
Ollie turned to look at her.
"Mom!"
"Keep your voice down, honey," she said. "We don't want the men to hear us."
She looked around. To her left was a large window, the blinds drawn. Next to the window was a dressing table, and facing her was the door. The couch was to the right of the sofa, and above it on the wall was a flat-screen TV. To her right was an open door leading into a bathroom.
"What are you going to do, Mum?" asked Ollie.
Let me think, honey," said Laura.
She stared at the duct tape binding her feet. It was presumably the same tape they'd used to bind her hands behind her. She needed something to cut through the tape. But what? She looked around. There was a comb on the dressing table, but it was plastic, and she doubted that would work. There was a framed photograph of a couple, a man and a woman. The frame looked as if it was made of metal, silver, perhaps, but the edges didn't look sharp enough to cut the tape. She looked over at the bathroom door. There might be something there she could use.
"Mum?"
said Ollie.
"Hush, honey," said Laura. "Let me think."
She rolled her legs over the side of the bed. They'd taken her shoes off, and her bare feet brushed the thick pile carpet. She stood up slowly. There was no movement in the tape around her ankles. She was going to have to jump, and she had no idea how much noise she would make. She hopped forward a few inches, and the floorboards creaked under the carpet. She stayed still, listening intently, until she was sure no one was coming upstairs, and she jumped again. The boards creaked louder this time. She sat back on the bed.
"Ollie, do you think you can sit up?" she asked.
"Why?"
"I need something to cut the tape," she said. "There might be something in the bathroom."
"Like scissors?" Like scissors, yes. But we need to be quiet. Now, can you stand up?
I'll try, he said.
Good boy.
Chapter 40 Ray knew that parking anywhere close to the stadium was going to be impossible on a match day, so he started looking for somewhere to leave the BMW once he got within half a mile. He saw a garage in a railway arch and pulled in. A mechanic in stained blue overalls was looking under the bonnet of a Mini Cooper, and he straightened up as Ray climbed out.
"Sorry, mate, I'm fully booked. You'll need to come back on Monday," said the mechanic, in a heavy Geordie accent.
Ray took out his money clip.
"Mate, I just need to leave my car here for an hour or so."
He gave the mechanic a £50 note.
"There's another one in your hand when I pick it up."
"I'm shutting up at 5, said the man.
"If I'm not back by 5, leave it on the street," said Ray.
He tossed the keys to the man.
"Just put them on the back near side wheel."
The mechanic slipped the note into the pocket of his overalls.
5 sharp, mind, he said.
But Ray was already running down the street towards the stadium. Chapter 41 Chelsea finished their warm-up first and jogged back to the tunnel to a tirade of abuse from around the stadium. When the visitors had left the pitch, McNamara waved his team back to the changing rooms. They jogged off the pitch and down into the tunnel. Gabe was first into the changing room, and he pulled open his locker and grabbed his phone. He stared at the screen, but his heart fell when he saw that Ray hadn't called. He flinched as McNamara blew on his whistle.
5 minutes, guys, shouted McNamara.
The squad began stripping off their training kit and changing into their match shirts. They all had 2 shirts to choose from, one short-sleeved and one long, but both covered with the same advertising, the brewing company that belonged to the Thai owner. Gabe went for the long-sleeve version. He pulled on his shirt, then sat down and adjusted his laces and shin pads. Armati was checking his hair in his locker mirror, then used some gel to get his quiff just right. He looked across and saw that Gabe was watching him.
"It's important to look good," said the Italian.
"Is it, though?" said Gabe.
"Or is it going to mean you fuck up the first time you head the ball?"
"Head the ball," said Armati. "Why would I head the ball? This game is called football, you know, not head ball."
He finished adjusting his hair and nodded at his reflection, then blew himself a kiss.
"Now, I am ready," he said.
Wood walked by and ruffled Armati's hair. The Italian cursed and launched a kick at Wood's backside, but Wood was too quick for him and skipped away.
"You bastard," shouted Armati. "You're only jealous because you're as bold as a...
He struggled for the word and looked over at Gabe.
"Coot," said Gabe. "Bold as a coot,"
shouted Armati. But Wood had already disappeared into the toilets. The Italian looked down at Gabe.
"What is a coot?"
"Some sort of bird."
"A bold bird?"
"I guess so," Gabe shrugged. "I don't know." His phone rang inside his locker, and he sprang to his feet. He pulled open the door and grabbed his phone.
"Yes, Ray, what's happening?" "I'm outside."
"Outside? Outside where?"
"Stadium."
"What the fuck are you doing here? Laura and Ollie aren't here."
"No, but C.K. Lee is. He's got a box."
"So we call the cops?"
"No, that won't work. If they arrest him, there's a good chance you'll never see Laura or Ollie again. I'll take care of it. But I can't get inside."
"Which entrance?"
"The main one."
"See if there's a steward there called Jerry. Jerry McGee." Gabe flinched as a whistle blew close to his left ear. He turned to see McNamara glaring at him.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" shouted the coach.
"This is important, Joe," said Gabe.
"Important? Are you having a laugh?"
McNamara jerked a thumb at the door.
"Out there is important. For the next 90 minutes, that's all that matters."
Gabe turned his back on the coach and walked away.
"Which entrance are you at?" he asked Ray.
"The main one, at the front."
"Go left to the players' entrance," said Gabe. "Find a steward called Jerry McGee and let me talk to him."
"Okay," said Ray. "Stay on the line, whatever you do."
McNamara walked around to stand in front of Gabe. He pointed his finger at Gabe's face.
"A grand. I'm feigning you a grand."
Gabe put his hand over the phone.
"Terrific. I'll give you the cash the moment the game's over.
Put that bloody phone down."
Gabe glared at the coach, then pushed past him, kicked open the door and hurried into the corridor.
He heard McNamara shouting after him, but all that mattered was getting Ray into the stadium. Chapter 42. Ray ran at full pelt, his arms pumping at his sides as his shoes slapped against the pavement, his phone clutched in his left hand. There were only a few latecomers still filing into the stadium, but they all turned to watch him run. He flew by two stewards, missing one by inches, and the man swore at Ray's back. He saw a sign saying, "Player's Entrance," and a steward in a fluorescent jacket standing in front of the turnstile. Ray ran up to the man.
"Are you Jerry?"
"Jerry?"
"Jerry McGee."
The man shook his head.
"Jerry's inside."
He was in his 40s with receding ginger hair and a transceiver clipped to his belt.
"Can you tell him I want a word?"
"He's busy, pal. There's a game about to start, in case you didn't know."
Ray resisted the urge to smack the man in the mouth and instead smiled and held up the phone.
"I'm Gabe Savage's brother," he said. "He's on the phone. Says I have to talk to Jerry."
The steward looked at his watch.
"Like fuck he is. The team is getting ready to go onto the pitch. The game's about to start."
Ray thrust the phone at the man.
"Speak to him yourself."
The steward took the phone, frowning, and put it to his ear.
"Who is this?"
he said. He listened for a few seconds, then muttered,
"Yeah, sure, no problem,"
and gave the phone back to Ray.
"Fuck me,"
he said.
"Wait here."
The man used a key card to operate the turnstile and disappeared into the stadium. He returned a couple of minutes later with another steward.
"I'm Jerry," said the man. "You're Gibbs' brother?"
Yeah.
Ray held out the phone.
"He wants to talk to you."
Chapter 43. Gabe paced up and down the corridor as he waited for McGee. The door to the visitors' changing room opened and the players began to file out. The Chelsea captain appeared and grinned at Gabe. "I thought your boss fined you for using the phone," he said. Gabe turned his back on him and walked down the corridor. McNamara came out and pointed a finger at Gabe. He was about to shout at him when he realised the Chelsea team were watching, so instead he stormed over to Gabe.
"Put that fucking phone away," he whispered. "I can't," said Gabe. "What do you mean?" "I have to take this call, Joe. I just have to. I understand the rules. You are going to have to do what you have to do, but I have to take this call. I'm sorry."
He heard Ray on the phone.
"He's here. Talk to him."
"One minute," Gabe said to the coach. "That's all I need." McNamara looked as if he was going to argue, but then the fight went out of him.
"One minute," he said, "or you can get dressed and fuck off."
He turned and walked away, slamming open the door to the changing rooms and disappearing inside.
"This is Jerry," said the steward in his ear. "Jerry, mate, I need a big favour," Gabe said.
"Sure, Gabe, no problem. My brother Ray's there. Can you let him in? I didn't have time to get him a ticket or put him on the list."
"Sure, I'll do that, no problem. Do you want me to take him to the family box?"
"Oh, he'll be okay, Jerry. I know you've got a lot to do. Thanks for this, I owe you."
"Anything for you, Gabe. And good luck out there."
Jerry ended the call and hurried back into the changing room as the rest of the United team were filing out. McNamara threw Gabe a withering look as he rushed over to his locker and tossed the phone inside. He went back into the tunnel and took his place at the head of the line, taking deep breaths to steady himself. McNamara looked at his watch, then gestured for Brett to open the door.
"Here we go, lads. Let's give it our best."
Gabe led the team out into the corridor. The opposition was already there, lined up, and the two teams walked quickly down the tunnel towards the pitch. The crowd began to cheer and chant, and Gabe felt the familiar vibration in his stomach that had the hairs on the back of his neck standing up. Gabe nodded at the Chelsea captain, and he nodded back.
"All right," he said.
"Yeah,"
said Gabe.
"According to the bookies, you're going to wipe the floor with us."
"That's what I heard."
"Fucking bookies, eh? What do they know?"
McNamara patted Gabe on the shoulder and pointed towards the stadium. Gabe took a deep breath and then started walking. The stadium erupted with cheers and chants, and he felt the familiar chill run down his spine as he stepped out into the daylight and the sound washed over him. Chapter 44. McGee pointed at a concrete stairwell in the corner of the stand next to a burger outlet where several home supporters were stocking up before taking their seats.
"The family box is on the next level," said the steward.
"Are you sure you don't want me to walk you up?"
"Oh, I'll be fine," said Ray. "You're a star."
He hurried to the stairs and ran up, taking them two at a time. There were boxes on all four sides of the stadium, on the first and second levels, and Ray had no way of knowing which one C.K. Lee was in. All Zoo had said was that Zoo's box was close to the halfway line. It wasn't quite a needle in a haystack, but it wasn't far off. He reached the first level. There was a wide corridor leading the full length of the stand. The doors to the boxes were to his left. Most of them were open. The boxes were pretty much identical, with an inside area with sofas and a dining area, then full-length glass sliding doors that led to the seating area. To the side of each door was a small metal card holder containing the name of whoever had use of the box. The first one was a well-known double glazing company, and half a dozen men in dark suits were drinking glasses of champagne. The second was in the name of G. Harrington, and the occupants were a mix of men and women. The men looked like drug dealers in leather jackets and Versace jeans, and the women almost certainly hookers. Again, champagne appeared to be the drink of choice, although this time it was Cristal and not the Bollinger that the double glazing team were knocking back. Ray heard the crowd start to roar. He stopped at the doorway to the third box. The door was open, and he could see through the box and onto the pitch, where the two teams were jogging out. Ray could see Gabe leading out the United team. Ray smiled to himself. It had been 10 years, give or take, since he'd seen his brother in the flesh. A sour-faced woman with scraped-back hair and a Botox-smooth forehead closed the door in his face. Ray grunted and continued down the corridor. Chapter 45. There were 42,000 people in the stadium, but all Gabe's attention was focused on one man, the referee. He was in his 40s, balding and slightly bow-legged. His name was Davy Scott, but he was Welsh. He had a cheap Casio watch on his right wrist and a chunky red gold decision system watch on his left wrist. The watch functioned as a secondary timepiece, but was connected to the stadium's £500,000 Hawkeye system, which used cameras to monitor the two goal lines between the posts and under the crossbars. When a ball crossed the goal line, the watch would vibrate and display the word goal. On his left arm, under his sleeve, was the bulge of his touchline power flags paging system, through which the assistant referees could communicate with him, using a system of beeps and vibrations. In a nylon holster secured to his shorts was an aerosol can of vanishing spray that he could use to mark where he wanted free kicks to be taken and to draw a line 10 yards from the ball to make sure that the defence kept their distance. The marks would disappear after a minute or so. The referee tossed the coin he was holding high in the air. "Heads," said the Chelsea captain. The coin landed on the turf, and Scott peered down at it.
"Heads it is," he said, straightening up so that both men could see it.
Chelsea made the obvious decision to play towards the home stand so that in the second half they would be playing towards their own supporters. Chelsea took their places and Gabe trapped the ball on the centre spot. He took a deep breath, knowing that the next 90 minutes would change his life forever. The referee blew his whistle and Gabe tapped the ball to Babacar on his left. Babacar sent it zipping along the grass to Jason Wood, and Wood tapped it across to Reed. It was a set piece they had rehearsed hundreds of times. As the Chelsea forwards rushed towards the ball, Gabe and Babacar sprinted toward the Chelsea goal. The Chelsea defenders moved to mark them. The crowd was buzzing in anticipation, and a loud, aggressive chant started in the north stand. Reed made his move, running hard and fast with the ball at his feet. Gabe scanned the pitch as he ran. There was an opening to the left where Reed could easily reach him with the ball, but Gabe broke right. He saw Reed frown in annoyance and then kick the ball over to Babacar. Babacar caught the ball on his chest, but as it dropped to the ground, he was tackled from behind and went down. One of the Chelsea defenders booted the ball towards the United goal, and the crowd groaned in frustration. Chapter 46. Ray reached the final box on the first level. It was the family box, from where Laura and Ollie were supposed to be watching the game. Two stewards were standing outside the door, and Ray moved over to the far side of the corridor as he walked by. The stewards looked at him, but realized he wasn't a gatecrasher or a threat, so they just smiled and nodded. Ray nodded back and headed for the stairs. There was another row of boxes on the second level, pretty much identical to the ones on the floor below. The problem was, there were also boxes in the other stand, several dozen in all, and Ray was running out of time. He heard a roar from the crowd and cheers, then a chant started. United! 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 He ran up the stairs and started walking quickly down the corridor. The door to the first box was closed, but the card in the holder on the wall said it was being used by a supermarket group. There was another loud cheer from the stadium that seemed to make the floor vibrate, followed by tens of thousands of people groaning in unison. Ray hurried down the corridor. Chapter 47. The Chelsea striker wrong-footed two United defenders and kicked the ball towards the goal, but the United keeper was already in position, and he caught it easily before taking three quick steps and booting it halfway down the field.
"What the fuck was that?"
asked Billy Huang, gesturing at the television.
"He wasn't even trying. How much do these fuckers earn a week? 100 grand? My aunt can kick better than that."
The United team were passing the ball back and forth, looking for an opportunity to press forward.
"Come on!" shouted Ricky Zhang. "Move yourselves! What are you doing?"
Teddy Kang looked up at the ceiling.
"Did you hear that?"
he asked. Zhang and Huang were engrossed in the game, and neither paid him any attention. Kang picked up the remote and muted the sound.
"What the fuck?"
said Zhang.
"Shut up," said Kang, getting to his feet. "I heard something."
He listened for a few seconds, but there was no repeat of the noise he was sure he'd heard.
"Yes!"
hissed Zhang. Kang looked over at him. Zhang was staring at the screen, his fists clenched. A Chelsea defender brought down a United attacker, and the ball rolled over the sideline.
"No!"
said Zhang, throwing himself back on the sofa.
"Did you see that? Did you fucking see that? He was heading for the goal, and that bastard brought him down with a late tackle. And what does the referee do? Nothing!"
Kang tossed the remote onto the coffee table and headed for the door. He pulled on his ski mask and took his gun from its holster as he padded up the stairs. Behind him, he heard the television sound go on again. He reached the door to where the woman and kid were being kept, and he placed his ear against it. He listened for several seconds and then pushed the door open. The woman was lying on her side, facing away from him. The boy was lying on his back, his eyes closed. Kang stepped into the room, and the woman rolled over and looked at him. Her eyes widened when she saw the gun in his hand, and he lowered the barrel so that it pointed at the floor.
"Can you check that my son is all right?"
she asked. Kang ignored her as he walked around the room looking for anything out of place. Then he checked the bathroom.
"Can he breathe all right?" asked the woman.
Kang came out of the bathroom and stared at her for several seconds.
"I heard a noise."
"He was coughing."
Kang looked over at the boy.
"He's not coughing now."
"I think he's having trouble breathing."
Kang walked over to the couch. The boy's ears were closed, but his chest was rising and falling as he breathed.
"He's asleep."
"Okay, thank you."
Kang reached down and checked the duct tape around the boy's ankles. It was secure.
"Has the match started?"
asked the woman as Kang straightened up. Kang nodded.
"Yes."
"Who's winning?"
"No one yet."
"That's good, right? Good for you?"
Kang walked over and stood looking down at her.
"Your husband's team has to lose."
"What if they don't lose?" asked Laura.
Kang shrugged.
"That depends on my boss."
He checked the tape around her ankles.
"You can't hurt a child, not because of a football match."
Kang shrugged again.
"Your husband was told what he has to do, and what will happen if he disobeys."
He grabbed her arm and rolled her over so that he could check her wrists. They were tightly bound.
"But it's not our fault," said the woman over her shoulder, "and it's not my son's fault."
Kang looked around at the room. Nothing had moved since he was last there, so far as he could see.
"Do you have children?"
she asked. Kang gestured at her with the gun.
Shut up, or I will gag you and the boy again.
Oh, okay, said the woman. I'm sorry.
She closed her mouth and forced a tight-lipped smile. Kang took one more look around the room and then went back downstairs. He stopped at the bottom of the stairs and listened for a few seconds, then went into the sitting room. Zhang and Huang were leaning towards the television, their eyes glued to the screen.
Come on, come on, Zhang was saying.
His hands gripped into tight fists.
Come on! What's the score?
Asked Kang, as he took off his ski mask. But before anyone could answer, he saw the numbers in the top corner of the television.
0-0. No score. Come on, said Zhang, louder this time.
Kang headed for the sofa, but before he could sit down, there was a flurry of action on the screen, and the ball rocketed into the back of the Chelsea net.
Who scored? Asked Kang.
United, said Huang. The black fella.
Babacar, said Zhang. He's from Senegal.
Where the fuck is Senegal? Asked Huang.
Africa, said Zhang. So, 1-0 to United, said Kang, sitting down and reaching for his brandy glass. CK is not going to be happy.
Chapter 48. Babacar was doing a moonwalk behind the goal as the home fans cheered him on. Reed was taking credit for the pass that Babacar had scored from, but Gabe knew that the ball had cannoned off the shoulder of one of the Chelsea defenders before Babacar had slammed it into the back of the net. It had been one hell of a goal, one that came close to justifying the player's £200,000-a-week salary. The Chelsea keeper was standing with his hands on his hips and a look of disgust on his face, shaking his head as if Babacar had done something wrong, but it had been a perfect goal. The keeper had done nothing wrong. He had placed himself in the centre of the goal and was anticipating the shot to come from Moretti, who'd been calling for the ball. Truth be told, Reed had aimed his cross at the Italian, but hadn't seen the Chelsea defender running across the penalty box. The ball had glanced off the defender's shoulder and shot across to Babacar, who'd reacted instinctively, swivelling on his back foot and putting his whole body weight behind a kick that sent the ball into the top left-hand corner of the goal before the keeper had any time to react. Gabe flinched as an arm fell across his shoulder.
"Fuck me!" shouted Michael Devereux in his ear. "That was a fucking goal and a half!"
Gabe forced a smile.
"Yeah. Come on, smile, Captain!" shouted Devereux. 15 minutes in, and we're 1-0 up!"
He punched the air and ran over to hug Reed. Babacar had stopped his moonwalk and was raising his arms in salute to the fans, beaming with pleasure. There was no better feeling than scoring a goal in front of a home crowd, Gabe knew. The love and admiration that poured out of the fans was like nothing else, though it could just as easily turn to vitriol and hatred when things weren't going their way. Gabe took a deep breath as he looked at the cheering fans, most of whom were now on their feet waving their scarves. He wondered how they would react if they knew that he was going to have to do whatever he could to make sure that United lost.
"Bloody hell, Gabe, smile!"
shouted Mapplethorpe behind him. The defender jogged over and drew back his hand for a high five. Gabe hit his hand, open-palmed, but with little or no enthusiasm.
"You okay?" asked Mapplethorpe.
"Let's not get overconfident," said Gabe. "The match has only just started."
"Fucking hell, you got out of the wrong side of the bed today," said Mapplethorpe. "We're going to demolish them, mate. Fucking demolish them."
He ran over to Babacar and gave him a high five, then stood in front of the screaming fans with his arms above his head. Gabe turned away and jogged back to the middle of the pitch. 1-0. 1-0. Chapter 49. TK Lee poured himself a slug of brandy and drank it down in one. A big-screen TV on one wall of the box was showing three pundits discussing the game. A former English international was explaining why he thought United were on target for a 3-0 victory.
"You know nothing!"
Lee shouted at the TV in Cantonese. The picture switched back to the game. Chelsea were kicking off. He looked through the full-length glass windows down to the pitch. It took him a few seconds to pick out Gabe Savage, standing close to the centre spot with his hands on his hips. His mobile phone buzzed in his pocket, and he took it out. It was Yung Jo Lung. There was no small talk from the man.
"A United win is no good to me," said Jung. I made that clear. Chelsea have to win this match.
It's okay. I have it in hand, said Lee.
You are sure? I have your word.
They will lose. There is no doubt.
You'd better be right, for your sake.
The line went dead. Lee poured another brandy and downed it in one as he looked down at the pitch. Chelsea were in possession, but their midfielders didn't seem to know what to do. They were passing it back and forth and making no progress. Lee looked for Gabe Savage again and found him in the middle of the pitch, moving aimlessly from side to side and making no attempt to intercept the ball. It had been fortuitous that Savage had been acting captain in place of Lebrun. The captain was the linchpin of any team, and Savage knew that if his team won, his family would be dead. Lee sipped his drink. It was more than a threat. Lee had every intention of killing the man's wife and son if United didn't lose. There was no point in making idle threats. If word got around that Lee didn't keep his promises, then before long no one would take him seriously. He poured himself another brandy. The big question was, what would happen to the wife and son if Savage did as he was told and United lost? Lee had no qualms about killing women and children. He'd had it done before, and he would no doubt do it again. He sipped his drink. If United lost, Yung-Jo Lung would be pleased. Or, at least, he would not be angry, which is probably all that Lee could hope for. Yung-Jo Lung wouldn't care one way or the other what happened to the wife and son. He was a pragmatist and would probably take the view that the fewer witnesses the better, but he would leave the final decision up to Lee. Lee had told Teddy Kang to make sure that the woman and the boy never saw the faces of their captors. Providing Kang and his men did their job properly, the hostages shouldn't have any information that would help the police, so freeing them wouldn't cause Lee any problems. And if he did have the family killed, Savage would certainly go to the police and tell them everything. Yung-Jo Lung's involvement in football gambling was well known, at least within the Chinese community, so an investigation into game-fixing would throw up his name sooner or later, and that was definitely something that would make Yung-Jo Lung angry. Lee stepped through the sliding glass doors to the seating area where two of his men were sitting in high-backed chairs watching the game. They raised their glasses to him in salute, and he nodded an acknowledgement. He sipped his drink again as he watched the Chelsea midfielders pass the ball between them. They seemed unsure of what they should be doing, and Lee shook his head in disappointment. They deserved to lose the way they were playing. As he watched, one of the United forwards managed to intercept the ball and the crowd roared. It was one of the Italians, Moretti. Moretti was a good player, but he had been a better fit at Liverpool, Lee knew. The manager, Guttuso, had brought him into the team, but Lee always thought the man had been thinking with his heart and not his head. Moretti ran with the ball, then stopped and looked around. Babacar had made his run, but had two Chelsea defenders sticking to him like glue. The Argentinian was running, but he was slow and had too much ground to cover. Moretti saw Gabe over to the left, and he sent the ball skidding across the grass about 20 feet ahead of him. Gabe sprinted towards the ball, but was a fraction of a second late getting to it, and the moment he trapped it, he was shouldered to the side by one of the Chelsea midfielders. Gabe lunged at the ball, but the midfielder was too quick, and he twisted around and passed it to a teammate who dribbled it towards the United goal. Gabe gave chase but was too slow. Chelsea were back in possession. Lee raised his glass to Gabe down on the pitch.
Just do what you're supposed to do, my friend, and everything will be all right, he said.
Chapter 50
I'm scared, said Ollie. The man might hear me.
Ollie was sitting on the couch facing her. Laura had wriggled into a sitting position with her back to the headboard.
He'll be watching the game on television, she said. All you have to do is move very slowly. You don't have to jump. Just shuffle your feet very slowly.
Can't we just wait, Mum?
We need to do this, Ollie, said Laura. Are you sure you can't cut the tape yourself?
His eyes brimmed with tears.
I'm sorry.
Laura forced a smile.
It's okay. Don't worry.
Ollie had managed to get a pair of nail clippers from the bathroom. It had taken him ages, and he got back to the couch just seconds before the man in the ski mask had come into the room. Ollie had been clasping the clippers in his hand, and the man hadn't seen them.
When the man had gone back downstairs, Laura had asked Ollie to try to cut the tape around his wrists with the clippers, but he just hadn't been able to do it.
"I'm useless," he said.
"You're not useless, honey," she said. "You did really well to get the clippers. Now all you have to do is get them to me."
"But I'm scared off all over."
"You won't. Not if you're careful," she said. "You've got great balance. You know you have. Now stand up, nice and slowly."
Ollie bit down on his lower lip, and he slowly stood up.
"Good boy," said Laura. "Now, shuffle over very slowly, bit by bit."
Ollie nodded. He began to swing his feet from side to side, inching forward, using his toes to dig into the carpet.
"Good boy," said Laura. "You can do it."